Nicholas Brody sat behind his desk, staring across his steepled fingers at Jake. The sec man occupied one of the chairs in front of the desk, his hat in his hands.
You're sure someone was murdered?
Yes, sir. That much blood had to be someone killed there.
And what makes you so certain? That blood you found up in those hills could have been where someone shot an animal, hopeful to provision their larder.
Jake shook his head. He opened a fist and displayed several bits of black fabric spotted with rust-colored blood.
That's from clothing, Mr. Brody. Shotgun pattern killed whoever was up on that ridge and tore bits of cloth from whatever he or she was wearing. We found pellets in the trees.
Brody glanced out the window at the school grounds. He couldn't believe something like this had happened. Never in all the years that his institution had been established had something so untoward occurred.
Was it school clothing from one of the missing boys?
Hard to say.
Your best guess, then.
Sir, with all respect intended, ain't no way I can tell you that. What I can tell you is this. The wag tracks on top of that ridgeline are fresh. Still got green plants crushed up in the clods they turned out of the earth. I'm guessing. But maybe there were as many as 6 or 7 wags.
That sounds like more than someone would need to spirit away those boys.
Yes, sir, I'm thinking so, too. Got a feeling we don't know the half of it. All them wags, they got themselves a regular convoy.
Do you think the boys went with them willingly?
Jake passed over a small object. Brody took it, examining it carefully, noting its needle-shaped end and the feathers that were obviously there for guidance.
A dart?
Trank. Shoot someone with it, knocks them out for a while. Maybe minutes, maybe hours, depending on what it's carrying. Found that one in a tree around the blood site.
You're suggesting the boys were abducted?
Yes, sir. Come to find out that Mr. Solomon is missing from the ranks as well.
All of these boys were a part of Mr. Solomon's pet group, were they not?
Yes, sir.
Except for Mr. Carter.
Only kitten in a litter of skunks.
Have you talked to Mr. Conover? I believe he was hurt yesterday morning.
Talked to him. Told me Mr. Solomon was running some special maneuvers last night with his group.
Without my authorization?
If you didn't authorize it, he did it without your authorization.
I didn't authorize it. Could you attempt to track these people down, Jake, and would you be willing?
Yes, sir, on both counts. But it's going to take considerable from the sec crew here, and I'll probably have to hire in some help from Leadville. Got some hard cases there do odd jobs when the jack's right.
I'll defer to your esteemed judgment in that matter, Jake, and I'll place whatever amount of jack you need at your disposal whenever you say. As far as the sec around this institution, we'll limp along without you for the time it takes. Just bring those boys back safe and sound.
I'll see it done, sir.
The sec man stood and clapped on his hat. Brody watched the man go and tried not to think of what might be happening to the missing boys. God forbid that he should have to tell any of their parents that he'd failed to protect them as he promised, especially Dean Carter's father. He'd heard numerous stories about the way the man had left Leadville after dropping off his son. Despite himself, Brody shuddered. Sundown advanced in earnest as Ryan, his companions, and their two guests reached the foothills of the low mountains surrounding Honey Lake. The dry heat of the Smoke Creek Desert had sapped him all day long, drawing the moisture from his body. Now, with the long shadows of night coming on, the wind blew cold, erasing the desert's heat. From behind the cover of some boulders, he waved the rest of the companions over. Ryan took out his night glasses and trained them in the direction of the noise. The land fell away from his position, settling into a bowl-shaped depression where a handful of campfires burned embers against the night. Tens of dimly lit figures surrounded the fires. All of them were gazing up at the starry sky. Christy crawled up on her elbows next to him.
Muties.
Ryan nodded, trailing his night glasses over the rad-blasted stick figures clad in tatters of human clothing and animal pelts. Many of them were nearly bald or were patchy from the radiated lands they'd spent years in. None of them had any weapons beyond a club or a knife, though some wore cow and buffalo skulls on their heads as armor. A few others had worked rib bones into decorative chest protectors. All of them were misshapen from leftover nuclear bombardment, covered with scabs and weeping open sores that leaked vile green pus.
What could they all be doing here?
I don't know. But causing all this noise seems out of place, too. Draw down the bigger predators on them in no time.
Ryan glanced back toward the others and waved them forward, signaling to Jack and JB that they were to come quietly. In seconds, the companions and the Heimdall Foundation members
were hiding behind the ridge overlooking the depression filled with muties. All of them kept their weapons at the ready. The two prisoners took time to pick up stones to defend themselves.
By the three Kennedys, they look like they are in the throes of some mystical epiphany. Look, they are not spending any time communicating with one another. Rather, they seem to be attempting to placate or seek acknowledgement from a being higher than themselves.
Muties with religion? No such thing, Doc.
Not religion. Fear. They're afraid of something, and they came here because they thought they might be protected.
From what?
I don't know. It's all mixed up. I don't have an image. I'm not sure that they know what's driven them here.
The space station? That's the only thing I know of going to make a difference around here tonight.
I don't know. Maybe.
Primitive instinct, maybe. Those muties live on an intellectual edge barely higher than most animals. Back in the 20th century, before California was nuked and collapsed off the face of the planet, scientists had already begun studying the effects of natural phenomena on animals. Back in the 20th century, before California was nuked and collapsed off the face of the planet, scientists had already been studying the effects of natural phenomena on animals. Earthquakes, flood, storms, extra hard winters, the lack of game. All things that take place in nature that humans have a hard time detecting, animals seem to know about ahead of time. Like they have an extra sense that humans forgot about or never developed.
This is true. Even after the invention of the seismograph, an observation of animals, especially their migratory habits, was maintained. Often the animals reacted to unknown stimuli that warned them, sometimes as much as days before data-gathering devices would report activity.
You think those muties can sense the space station coming down out of the sky? That's preposterous! It took the teams at the Heimdall Foundation months to track Shostakovich's anvil.
And you people got it wrong once already, or else you wouldn't have been up around the Seven Vills. I see these muties sitting here now, waiting for what you say is going to happen.
How far are we from the area where it's supposed to come down? JB took out his mini-sextant and did his calculations. While the armorer was busy, Ryan kept watch over the muties. They were growing more agitated, shifting individually and in small groups, not really noticing now when others encroached on their space.
About 300 yards north and west of our position.
Ryan turned his night glasses away from the muties and looked toward Honey Lake. The body of water was much larger than indicated on the map they'd been working from. It glistened, dark and oily, in the distance, acting like a mirror for the stars and moon above. Then, a flare ignited, reflected on the lake's surface as it skipped between the stars like a rock skimming waves. Ryan glanced back up, knowing what he was actually seeing was in the sky. Christy grabbed his arm and pointed east.
There!
Ryan stared at the orange-white burn streaking across the sky. It looked only inches long, but he knew what he was looking at was actually several miles in length. Below their position, the muties were all pointing skyward. More wood dropped onto the campfires, making the flames reach even higher. The space station, if that was what it truly was, fell quickly. The orange faded to yellow as the heat increased, then turned white. Streaking earthward, the space station's trajectory abruptly changed. It's breaking apart.
No!
Bernson almost made it over the ridge before JB grabbed the man by the shirt collar and hauled him back.
No, it can't break apart! It's not supposed to do that!
Stay put or you'll never get the chance to tell anyone you saw this. I'd sooner kill you than let the muties have a chance because they'd take us right along with you.
Bernson stuffed his fists against his mouth, shaking his head from side to side. Ryan watched as the space station broke up into at least four pieces. He thought he might have seen a fifth go spinning away to the south, but whatever trail it might have made disappeared quickly against the harsh light of the reentry burn. The light was so bright it reduced the night's shadows to pinpricks against the uneven ground. The largest piece continued along its trajectory toward Honey Lake. The lake's surface blazed with white fire, shimmering across the surface. Only a few pockets of darkness left, where debris shoved up through the water.
Dark night. That damn thing's so big it's gonna fall on top of us.
Stand your ground. If we start moving, we could end up right under it, or the muties will see us. The companions all dug into the ground, watching the falling space station's final approach. 150 yards from the mutie campsite, it slammed into the ground, sundering the rock and scattering sand before it like an ocean wave. The sand washed over the muties, knocking dozens of them to the ground. A moment later, the space station wreckage rolled over them, pulping them against the desert floor. The closer ranks of muties broke and ran, coming up the grade toward the companions. Behind them, red hot and throwing off heat waves that could be felt even along the ridgeline, a chunk of space station skidded toward Honey Lake. In seconds, it shot out over the black depths and sank, blowing eerily until it disappeared. The fleeing muties raced on a direct course to overrun the companion's position. "Move back!" Ryan brought the Stire to his shoulder. He fired in quick succession, shots that mowed down five muties, bullets driving deep through their chests and faces. The other muties gave their comrades little attention, trampling over them. But recognizing a threat they could deal with, the muties raised clubs and axes, bared blades and spears, and continued to run. JB raised his Uzi. The rounds cut a swath in the ranks of the muties. JB ducked behind a boulder to change clips.
"Ryan, we aren't going to be able to hold them back."
Sparing a glance over his shoulder, Ryan watched as Christie guided Doc farther back into the broken landscape, Burnson at their heels. Pulling out his .357 Magnum pistol, Jack covered their backs. Coyle was cut down as a hard-thrown spear took him in the back, sliding into his heart, then bursting through his chest. Ryan exchanged looks with JB.
"Time to go."
"Ready. Follow my lead."
"Do it."
Ryan was no more than 10 feet behind JB when they broke into a run. The muties were almost within clawing distance, and a spear sailed over Ryan's shoulder, dropping point first into the inclined terrain ahead of him. Ryan cut hard to the left.
Fire blast.
He saw the rectangular shape of a wag crest the ridgeline to the left of where he'd seen Christie go. He had no doubt to whom it belonged. Other wags joined the first. Their lights blazed over the sudden battleground.
"JB?"
"I see them."
Heavy machine guns mounted on the wags started blasting away. Tracer rounds flared purple against the velvet night. 50-caliber death drummed into the muties, spinning them, dumping them from their feet, knocking them onto their backs. Ryan went to ground behind an outcrop as the wag switched on its lights. He brought up the Stire and put rounds through the driver's side of the windshield. One of them cratered the hood over the engine. One of the armored vehicles suddenly zipped out of the formation. As the headlights came around, Ryan spotted Mildred trying to outrun the wag. The driver stayed with her without running her down.
"Millie!"
For a moment, Ryan lost sight of the action as more wags cut off the woman's escape route. Abruptly, the wag trailing her slewed sideways. Two men in back, who'd been manning the machine guns, whipped out a section of heavy netting equipped with weights. The net flew true, unfurling in midair until it dropped around Mildred. She went down hard, trying to free herself. The two men jumped down and pushed her back to the ground. When they cleared off her, she wasn't fighting anymore. Ryan shot one of the two men who'd thrown the net. The Stire's round blasted the man backward over the side of the wag. A machine gunner opened fire on Ryan's position. Wads of dirt and rock ripped loose around him. He sank back into cover. Slinging the rifle, he drew the Sig Sauer. JB was already moving in on Mildred's position. 2 3-round bursts knocked down two other men trying to lift the woman from the ground. Ryan took that as a sign of hope. If they'd killed her, they'd have left her there. He broke cover and ran toward the nearest wag, the Sig Sauer raised before him. The second man on the passenger side noticed him too late. Bright scarlet blood, illuminated by the lights from the other wags, splashed against the fractured windshield inside the wag's cab as a sec man dropped inside the vehicle. Ryan shot the driver right between the eyes. He grabbed the door latch and yanked. The sec man's body tumbled to the ground as a hail of bullets punched through the door. Having no choice, Ryan abandoned his position. He dove toward the back of the truck, spotting one of the saddle tanks. He threw himself under the wag and unleathered his Panga. 3 quick thrusts opened holes in the gas tank. Liquid spilled out of the holes, pooling rapidly in the sand. The sec man cautiously approached the side of the wag. Ryan scrambled through on the other side and saw JB cutting away at the net that held Mildred. Ryan grabbed one of the flares he'd taken from the Raider, popped it, and threw the hissing thing into the gasoline. Flames spread across the pool, then started leaping up the torrents pouring from the ruptured gas tank.
"Cover it, JB! Fire in the hole!"
An instant later, the gas tank under the wag exploded. Several pieces ripped the sec man to shreds, and 2 of the wag's rear tires went flat. Ryan pushed himself to his feet. Alerted by movement in his peripheral vision, he whirled toward JB and ran toward him, but was too late.
JB turned and fell to his knees. He dropped the Uzi before Ryan covered the distance.
JB!
Once he was close enough, Ryan saw the fletched darts buried deeply into the side of JB's neck and cheek.
Oh, fire blast.
Go. They don't want us dead right now. Maybe we got some time. As long as you and the others are free.
If there's any way, JB, I'll be there for you.
I know you will.
JB was almost prone on the ground, his hand reaching for Mildred's. He almost made it before the drug in his system shut him down. Ryan turned, looking for targets, just as a small wag rocketed at him. It skidded in the sand and loose rock as the driver tried to avoid a head-on collision. Unable to get out of the way, Ryan leapt onto the wag's hood so he wouldn't go down under the wheels. Out of control, he smashed up against the windshield, fracturing the glass with his body weight. He recognized a startled Hayden Lamarck on the other side of the spiderweb windshield. The wag skidded to a stop, sending Ryan flying off to land hard in the sand. Ryan tried to raise himself on his arms, but felt the sharp bite of trank darts pinning him from his knees to his neck. The last thing he saw was Lamarck's boots walking toward his face. When Ryan went down less than 60 yards from her position, Christy started for the top of the ridge, snapping the cylinder of her .38 closed after reloading. Before she reached the top of the ridge and could be seen, Jack wrapped his strong arms around her, pulling her down by himself and Doc. He clapped a hand over her mouth and put his face close to her ear.
It do Ryan no good you go running out there.
Christy gave up the struggle almost at once, anchored in the harsh realities of the situation. She pulled Jack's hand away.
It's okay. I'm not going out there.
Below, sec men surrounded Ryan and carried him to the back of a wag. Christy watched until she couldn't see him anymore.
We follow, but first disappear. We caught now, no one to come rescue.
We're going to find them.
Yes, dear lady, we shall. And it appears we have at least some time on our hands. The big game in Vegas is not until 6 more days.
Christy chewed her lip. Transportation would be a problem. The wags could go much faster than they could. Crossing the desert on foot to Vegas would be almost impossible. Even if they made the distance and on time, when they got there, they'd be in no shape to help anyone.
Gaia, help us find a way.
She followed Doc, while Jack kept point, motioning to Burnson to keep up with him as they escaped notice. Wallace Thorogood gazed into the back of the wag where the three captured Outlanders lay caged and still unconscious.
Got 3 of them, sir.
Lamarck stood next to Baron Hardco and gazed around the battlefield. Everything was a flurry of activity as the SEC team secured their gear, tended to the wounded, and made what repairs were necessary to the wags. 2 of the vehicles appeared destroyed. One had been set on fire by the one-eyed man, and the resulting explosions had killed 4 men and burned the wag badly. The second wag was lost when a group of muties had attacked it with rocks and spears, careless of their own lives. It was battered, smashed, and the tires were dug into the sand over their axles. Lamarck mentally wrote it off as too much trouble to salvage and looked at the 3 captured Outlanders.
There are still 3 of them out there, Baron.
I know, Hayden, but how many men is it going to cost us to try to dig them out? No, cut our losses here. 3 of them, from what I've seen, are going to tip the odds in our favor in the big game. Maybe we ought to be satisfied with that much.
Yes, sir.
Get your men ready. I want to shake the dust from this place in 10 minutes or less.
Lamarck went to see that it was done, but he hoped that the other 3 would find a way to follow them. If they arrived in Vegas before the representing teams were dropped into the pit, they could be added. Mildred pressed her face against the bars of the cage they were in on back of the flatbed wag, driving in line with the Baron's convoy. The sun was going down, setting in ochre and amber behind them as they traveled east. Ryan roused himself from semi-slumber against the cab of the wag and joined Mildred. JB got on the other side. The remains of the entertainment city lay like a dying neon rose in the parched sand of the desert. Dozens of colors sprayed across the broken buildings jutting from the landscape.
Welcome to Las Vegas. Oh,
Skydark was hard on this bird. It used to be something to look at.
You been here?
A couple of visits. First time was when I was a college freshman. Sort of to get the bridle in my teeth and prove I could do anything I wanted to do.
Ryan ran his gaze over the wreckage of the city. There were some tall buildings among the shorter ones. But at some point, decades past, quakes had riven Vegas, splintering it and leaving huge gaping cracks in the streets. The tectonic pressures had also tumbled down most of the taller buildings.
How well do you think you remember your way around the Ville?
Depends on where we go. Vegas is built on a strip where all the action stayed. Provided the pit the game is being held in is located somewhere in that. And the landmarks weren't too screwed up by the quakes and whatever scavengers there might have been. I can find my way around.
Gives us an edge.
Mighty slim one.
Gonna have to work with what we have.
He stayed at the bars, studying the Ville as the convoy drew closer. According to Lamarck, and what Ryan had learned from the Heimdall Foundation men, the killing was scheduled to begin at midnight. He'd wondered about that at first, trying to understand how they'd be able to wander around in the dark and tell who was killing who. But seeing the way the neon lights lit up the Ville's inner core resolved that mystery. All that remained was the living and the dying.
Is that the wag housing our companions, Christy?
From their vantage point, up above the narrow road that led down into Vegas, Christy adjusted the magnification on her binoculars. She brought the first few wags into focus, not recognizing anyone. The first wag slowed to cross a narrow wooden bridge that linked the cracked remnants of the highway on either side of a 12 or 15-foot fissure that looked almost as deep. Twilight made it harder to judge distances. She moved back, scanning each wag in turn. She knew Lamarck by sight. During the last three of the 6 days they'd spent pursuing the convoy, she'd marked the Sec Commander's face, knowing him from the description Ryan and Burnson had provided, the latter confirming it visually on one occasion. The initial 3 days of the pursuit, the companions had traveled hell-bent for leather using the wags they salvaged from the battle. Christy couldn't fathom people being that wasteful, but she thanked Gaia for her enemy's short-sightedness. A map of the southwestern United States found in the overturned wag had helped them considerably, but had been misleading at times as well. When they'd caught up with Hardco's convoy, they had slowed down, waiting for an opportunity to free Ryan, JB, and Mildred. It hadn't happened. The Baron's Secman had kept too tight a rein on things. Jack had come the closest to breaking into the camp, but even he had almost been found out before he could get within 100 yards of the wags. Secman in hiding had sprung their trap too early. Jack had gotten away, but the episode had let them know that Hardco's men considered Ryan and the others as bait, as well as a prize. A few wags farther down the convoy, Christy found their captured companions. She focused the binoculars on Ryan, his face visible to her. By his features, she knew he was plotting and planning. He hadn't given up at all.
It's them.
Feel pretty with all them lights. Baron must have lots of gas and generators. Nobody know, only chillin' waiting inside.
Well, against yon walls and phantasmal fairy illuminations, we shall test our mettle and discover if we should be found yet wanting in purpose and desire.
Christy, sec pretty tight on the bridge. How we cross?
On foot. There's no other choice. We'll carry as much gear as we can. Darkness should cover us well enough.
We're just going to get caught.
Jack popped the hood on the wag and took the starter coil, pocketing it as he eyed Burnson.
Can leave you here.
Burnson shuddered. His eyes looked dead as he mopped his forehead with his sleeve.
No, I'm afraid that won't do at all.
Doc, Jack, strip down your gear. Keep the weapons and medication, anything that will help once we reach Ryan and the others. Everything else we leave here.
You do realize someone may find the wag?
Maybe. And maybe they won't find it until the big game is over and we have the others out. We have to take the chance.
This is, I've heard, certainly the place for taking chances and hoping for long shots to come through.
Inside Vegas, the wag carrying Ryan, JB, and Mildred split off from the others and rolled down the cracked and crumbled streets. A contingent of pedestrian Secmen fell into a jog beside the wag. Ryan stared. The brightness of the neon lights increased, and the range of colors were incredible.
I know where we're at.
Where?
South Las Vegas Boulevard. Back in my day, they called it the Strip. See? Over there is the MGM theme park.
Ryan peered in that direction, barely making out the framework of the building. He spotted the massive statue of a lion toppled over in the street in front of the structure. The huge head had broken off and was separated from its body by dozens of yards. A scar tracked its right cheek, deep and irregular enough to have been caused by a mortar round. Ryan watched carefully. He read the signs of the places and streets they passed. A huge building with a glittering entranceway stood on the edge of a precipice. Neon lights announced the name as Bally's. Ryan figured it was the one Mildred had been talking about. The wag turned off the main drag and followed a path over built-up patches filling the cracks in the ground. Ryan shifted, holding onto the bars with one hand, as he watched a steel door in the wall before the wag. The steel door wasn't part of the original building. It had been added sometime later. Rust covered the facade, blending the dents and tears into a rugged sameness. The steel door went up, slowly. The wag driver came to a near stop, then edged forward until the door cleared the top of the vehicle. Inside the parking area beyond, Hayden Lamarck had a full complement of SEC men armed to the teeth. Light came from fluorescent tubes on the high ceiling, supplemented by oil lanterns hanging on the walls and carried by some of the SEC men. The steel door slowly closed. A large, burly man unlocked the cage and pulled the door back.
Out!
Ryan led the way out of the wag. He signaled to JB with his fingers, telling the armorer to stand and observe. Lamarck stopped in front of Ryan, remaining out of easy reach.
Are you ready?
I have a choice.
Lamarck smiled, but it wasn't a confident effort. He turned to one of the other men.
Get him suited up.
Less than 10 minutes later, Ryan, JB, and Mildred found themselves outfitted with a scarlet armored bodysuit that covered chest, stomach, and groin, and waiting in a large public meeting place of some kind, lit by oil lanterns hanging on wall hooks that left soot patterns on the decorative walls. Ryan reckoned it had been a gaudy of some type at one time, judging from the shelves, remnants of mirrors, and freestanding bar against the back wall. Ryan also had his holster, though empty of the 6-hour P226, and pouches and pockets for ammo and other gear. Lamarck strode in and stood in front of the opposite wall, which had taken heavy damage in the past. Sledges had been used to knock out sections of it, and glass panes had been puttied in, creating a 10-foot-wide and 6-foot-tall window that looked out over some of the worst carnage in Vegas. It looked as though a giant had stomped a footprint into the center of the ville, just beyond Bally's. Keeping his sense of direction, even after he'd been brought into the building, had been second nature for Ryan. He knew they were facing north. The neon glare of the ville was strongest at this point, teeming with dozens of colors of differing intensities. The lights slammed against the windows, all of them offset from the others, and created prism effects that spun out over Ryan, JB, Mildred, and the nearest SEC men. Lamarck stood before them with his hands behind his back.
You people have been given a great honor to be selected as Baron Hardcoast champions.
JB spat on the floor. The spittle splattered over the SEC commander's boots. Color rouged Lamarck's face, but he maintained his calm.
In a few minutes, you're going to be released into that pit. Quakes dropped the center of this area years ago. The Barons all worked together to build a restraining wall around the outside of the pit area, and to rebuild some of the things inside, like the neon lights.
Ryan could barely make out the metal wall created from pieced-together slabs of concrete and sections of metal.
You can't get over it. It's 40 feet tall. Barbed wire strands circle the top another 6 feet over that. Concrete was poured on top of the wall beneath the wire, and glass, nails, and shards of metal were mixed into it. Even if you found rope and a grappling hook and could throw it that high, the rope would be cut by the glass and shards on top of the wall. Not to mention the fact that you'd be perfect targets for the snipers along the outer perimeter.
Staring back through the window, Ryan glimpsed two of the guards in the foreground, obviously walking predetermined areas.
Who's guards?
Thinking, are you? Good, I like that. Knew the survival instinct would kick in along the way. The guards are from all the Baron's camps, with overlapping fields of fire on the pit fighters as well as one another. In years past, one of the Barons had the idea of using a couple of his wall guards as snipers.
They had silenced weapons, thought they wouldn't be noticed. But they were, and they were shot. For every man they shot, one of that Baron's men was shot. The two that were left over didn't last long.
You said there'd be 10 of us.
And there will be. I wanted to talk to the three of you. You're used to working as a unit, got a lot of hard miles on you from the look of you. Saw how you went through those raiders. The other 7 aren't going to be much help, I'm afraid. Unless you can convince them to listen to you.
What's in the pit besides the other teams?
Muties, scabbies, and stickies. Animals, some of them muties, some of them not. Four-legged. Snakes. We got some water traps in there with poisonous eels, piranha, anything nasty that could live and kill in that environment.
If we win, we're going to be set free?
Yes. How much do you know about the 5 barons and the 7 vills?
Man whose team wins this gets control of the 7 vills for a year.
What about Baron Sparning Hardco?
I was told he was one of the more efficient chillers in the group. Runs second to Baron Conrad in numbers of his private army.
Huh. Well, there's more to Baron Hardco than that.
Yeah, I can see how he'd give folks that impression, what with the way he invites some of them to play this game for him.
The Baron is building docks and boats in the 7 vills, building up trade along the northern Scythic coastline. People are moving into the vills now instead of working to stay away from them. There's work there, homes, maybe a future if they all pull together. I'm trying to give you something to fight for. What's at stake is bigger than just the people in this room. I want you to see that.
If you believe in what Hardco's doing so much, why don't you go get 9 other people who can fight and believe in the Baron as much as you do? And you jokers take a dive into that pit tonight.
Lamarck's lips tightened, as though he'd just bitten into a sour lemon.
Move out. Only got a few minutes before they start releasing you people into the pit.
After passing through musty hallways outside rooms that were filled with wrecked furniture, overturned gambling tables, and skeletons of people that had died of rad drift, Ryan stood in the center of a smaller room lined with metal walls. Lamarck and his men left them there, bolting the door behind them. The ceiling had been torn out, leaving an upper level where people could look down on them. A short railing covered with wrapped lengths of razor wire surrounded the opening. In a short time, Lamarck was at the railing, gazing at them. A net was suspended from the ceiling above the sect boss, a length of steel cable running through a pulley system, holding it in place.
Our weapons?
That's right. Figured you might give a better accounting of yourselves if you had the tools you were most familiar with. You'll find they've been well taken care of, and there's ample ammunition for all of them.
What happens when we run out?
Hopefully, you'll be sparing with it and pick your targets. Along the way, you'll find you can pick up more from the other teams, assuming that you've killed them. And there are caches where more ammunition has been placed.
Ryan stared at the double doors in front of him that undoubtedly led into the pit. He crossed the distance and pushed against them. Neither moved.
Bring the rest of them in!
7 hard-eyed men entered the room. Of them all, the black giant, his hair tied with bits of cloth, captured Ryan's attention. The black man's eyes held yellow madness, like someone who had traveled too long in the rad-blasted lands. His hands were secured behind him. One of Lamarck's sec men moved in behind him and keyed open the cuffs. Giving no warning, the black giant turned and backhanded the sec man. The man flew through the air and crumpled against the wall by the door, unconscious or dead. Blood trickled from his ears.
Black Michael!
The giant ignored the sec commander and leapt to the door, trying to pry it open with his thick fingers. The other 6 new arrivals quickly put distance between themselves and the big man.
Stop, you bastard, and move away from that door, or I swear I'll chill you myself.
Do that, and you'll be a man short.
Black Michael moved away from the door just the same. He reached up to his shoulders and started pulling on his armor straps.
Leave that on!
Fuck you!
The straps gave way, and the body armor dropped to the floor. Michael's naked chest, shoulders, and abdomen rippled with sweat-slick muscles.
If I'm gonna die, I'm gonna die my way. Shirt makes too much color in the night. Like this, no one see me.
Lamarck said nothing, stepping aside as 5 men moved into view at the railing. One of them Ryan recognized as Hardco. He guessed the others were barons as well. All of them had bands tied around their left biceps. Hardco's was red. The other colors were purple, orange, green, and blue.
I count nine in your color, Hardco.
The tenth man refuses to wear his armor, Baron Conrad.
Rules say the champions are supposed to wear their color. Keep down confusion on who's who.
No, the rules don't say that. As to confusion, take a look at this man. I don't think there'll be any confusion with him.
Conrad scowled but said nothing more. The group passed on. Grinning, the giant crossed the room to Mildred.
Black like me.
Black, but not like you at all.
Black Michael raised a hand as if he were about to slap her.
No!
JB stepped forward in a combat stance, his hands loose and ready before him. Black Michael turned to face the armorer. He dwarfed JB in height and in build.
You think you mean enough to take me, little man?
Up to you whether we find out.
Break you in half like a stick.
The armorer didn't make a reply, slowly reaching out and moving Mildred behind him out of the big man's zone.
This man's something special to you. You don't have to tell me. I can see in your eyes. Maybe I'll catch up to you and him out there in the dark in those pretty lights. I twist his head, and you can hear how his neck cracks and see him jump when he dies. Wait for me out in the dark, little man, and I'll be there soon.
Extra baggage. See no sense in taking it along.
JB nodded. Black Michael ignored them. Up above, Lamarck's sec team raised two sheets of see-through plas and braced it with 4x4 beams, booting them together in an L shape.
Lower the weapons!
The net descended into the room. Ryan, JB, and Mildred were the first to reach the net as it came within grasp. The other men came swiftly, shoving at one another to claim their weapons. JB reached into the net and pulled his S&W scattergun from the collection. Moving quickly, he jacked around. Ryan took up his own P226 and worked the slide, slipping the first round into the chamber. As he watched, Black Michael picked up a huge revolver. It was a large weapon by any standard, but looked small in the ebony giant's fist. Without warning, JB shoved the shotgun's muzzle into Black Michael's face and pulled the trigger.
What the hell are you doing?
Ryan fired two shots, aiming for Lamarck's heart. He wasn't surprised to see them leave splintered fractures across the surface of the plexiglass, but not penetrate. Two sec men stepped around the edge of the plexiglass, only exposing enough of themselves to aim their weapons into the room below.
No! Leave them alone! Any man raises a weapon against them dies by my hand!
The sec man calmed down, grudgingly.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Man wasn't going to work with us. Figured we weren't going to let him work against us either.
You stupid son of a bitch. You've got one less man to fight for the Baron.
Tell the Baron he's always welcome to join in. Fight for himself.
Ryan turned to the other six men, ignoring the sec boss.
How many of you want to take a chance on getting out of here alive?
Why the hell should we join up with you? Well, I understand it. It's every man for himself out there.
Maybe. But if you aren't working with me, then I'll put my sights on you when I see you. Work with me. Maybe we can find a way clear of here.
Have you seen that wall? Fuck. Ain't no way we're going to climb that.
In or out?
Though he kept the barrel pointing down, Ryan swiveled the six-hour in the man's direction.
Don't give a fella much choice.
Choices ended the minute Hardco's people dropped you in this hell pit.
Lady's right, Owen. If we don't throw in with him, it maybe means going up against him in the end. Seems to know his business all right. Maybe with him, we'll have a chance of getting clear of this once and for all with a whole skin.
Fuck. That still leaves us going up against him in the end.
Don't have to be that way.
You see any other way for it?
Yeah. All of us getting out of here.
Mister, I don't know where you're from, and I don't give a fuck, but you gotta know one thing from the get-go. Ain't nobody ever escaped from the pit once they were shut up in it.
You mean nobody yet?
Oh, he's got brass, Fielding. Gotta give him that. I'm Owen. This is Fielding. Two skinny Jaspers in the back are Tyler and Taylor Thompson. Twins, if you ain't made that out yet. Heavy guy's Moosh Wandum, and that leaves Clingdon.
I'm Ryan, and this is JB and Mildred. You people know each other?
Nah. The twins knew either other, and the rest of us met on the wag. Knew Black Michael's name, because the sec guards were always having a hard time with him. Heard he bit a man's cock off in Jakestown before they put him on the wagon and brought him out here. Bastard's sick son of a bitch.
You know what we're up against?
Some of it. Sick men like trying to scare the shit out of us telling stories.
Start off figuring it's all gospel. We'll find out the truth of it as we go along. We're going out there together. You move when I say move, where I say move, and you move damn fast.
You know something we don't? That why you were getting such special treatment?
Hell, Fielding. I'd never even heard of the Vills or the big game a little over a week ago.
What? So this is all new to you? Why should we listen to you?
This pit's new to me, but Chilling isn't. There's a certain safety in numbers.
Open the doors! It's time!
In short order, the light from inside the room spilled onto the wreckage of buildings, soaking up the neon glamour of the Baron's private killing ground. Ryan stepped forward, the Sig Sauer in his fist, as he scanned the edges of the wall less than 10 feet higher than his present position. Moonlight and neon reflected from the keen edges of the razor wire looped around the poles set on top of the wall surrounding the quake-sunk area. Other patches gleamed as well, glass and sharp bits of metal. Ryan glanced at the ground. The terrain had been shaped over the years, falling away as much as 15 feet in a direct fall, then sloping away to the floor of the pit. He thought he could see two other groups making the jump into the battle zone to the west of them. He also spotted some bulky shapes moving casually through the dark, and some feline ones as well.
Get outside!
Fucker can't make us do that!
As if he'd heard the man, the Sec Commander made a show of pulling a pin on a grin, counting down, then dropping it into the room.
Move!
When the grin blew, it spewed forth chunks of black Michael that rained all over the terrain. Something in a pool of water only a few yards away reared up, seized one of the ebony giant's hands in its sharp teeth, and pulled it into the mud-colored liquid. Overhead, the doors closed, cutting off any hope they might have had about using the room as an escape hatch later. Ryan looked at his team, perspiration already making his skin slick under the armor.
JB, you've got point. Mildred, you're behind him, leading these men. I'm walking slack. Weapons out, safety's on until I tell you otherwise. We're gonna keep a low profile for as long as we can. Kill quick and kill silent if we get the chance. Those other teams can take each other out for a while. They do it proper and really work on it. Maybe they can cut down the odds for us. Questions? Right. Move out!
Ryan stayed 10 yards ahead of his group, Punga in his right hand. Most of the neon lights were mounted on the buildings on either side of the cracked street, 20 yards to their left. A few of the buildings were whole, but most of them were smashed. Fields of brightly colored illumination overlapped one another, creating even more tints, ripping away even the blackest shadows. Glancing up at the wall 40 feet above him, 20 feet above the nearest and tallest tree, Ryan saw the perimeter guards walking their assigned posts. Killing them from that distance was simple enough, especially with the Steyr slung over his back, but it didn't give them a way out. He moved on, looping around a collection of busted and rusted wags. He backed away a half step from the vehicle as a serpent's head shot out of the dark recesses. The snake's mouth was wide open, jaws distended, and fangs glistening bone white. Ryan raked the Panga through the thick neck behind the wedge-shaped head, decapitating it.
Ryan!
I'm okay.
He scanned the wag for any further movement. Nothing else appeared. He took up point again, then noticed the shifting shadows under a series of forked branches from a 15-foot-tall dead tree. The back of Ryan's neck tightened as he felt eyes on him now. A gleam of metal flickered, picking up a purple and then a turquoise haze from the neon light surrounding them. He reached down for the Sig Sauer, moving sideways so his gun hand was away from them. Clearing the Sig Sauer of leather, Ryan dodged the Mutie Lion that leapt at him from the tree branches above. Dean glanced at the second story, through the hole that had been chopped, through the ceiling of the first floor room he was in. Baron Vinge Conrad's sec teams poured liquid into the room from a 55-gallon drum. The choking chemical odor told Dean what it was.
Gasoline!
They all retreated to the farthest wall. Perry had drawn back, separating himself from the rest of the group, even though he wore the same green armored vest as they did. Dean pressed against the double doors that would open onto the pit area. He was tired from 7 days of travel, of constantly looking along their back trail to see if his dad or some of Brody's set people were following. And all that time, he'd seen no one. Now his nerves were stretched tight as cat got on a bow. Adrenaline surged inside him as the gasoline pooled around their feet. Lewis's blonde hair was plastered to his skull by the heat that had stifled them in the room.
Ah, dirty fuckers! You brought us all this way just to set us on fire? Is that it?
Dean pulled his Browning high power. Solomon had stolen it out of Nicholas Brody's safe, proving that the phys ed teacher hadn't planned on going back to the school after the transaction, and had given it to their captors with an explanation that it was Dean's personal weapon. Binge Conrad had been pleased to discover that Dean had such a weapon, and had made returning the weapon a presentation just before the other boys were armed. Dean fired at the sec boss, now brandishing an unlighted torch. The bullet plunked into the see-through plexiglass on a tangent that would have put it squarely between his target's eyes. The sec boss nearly fell over himself trying to get away, then glared at the misshapen chunk of lead hanging in front of him. Ethan Perry pushed himself off the wall and came at Dean.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Shifting the Browning to cover Perry, Dean stared at him.
Don't!
Lewis moved into position beside Dean, his pistol in both hands, but not pointed at anyone.
Back off!
Perry made a move to pull his own gun.
No, Perry. You do it, and I'll put you down myself. Stoop fucker's gonna set off the gasoline shooting that damn gun. He does. They do. You really give a shit which way it goes?
Conrad's sec boss smirked as he looked down at the trapped boys.
You little boys got more sand in you than I'd have thought. Maybe the Baron did have the right idea.
Psst, Lewis. Ceiling up there is made of metal and concrete. Bullets will bounce pretty damn good. Figure the angle's right, that bulletproof glass won't do dick for them.
Lewis glanced upward slightly and gave Dean a tight nod.
Better than dying in here with nothing done. Moxon.
Yeah?
Cover Perry. He moves, tries to pull his blaster, gun him down and be done with it.
You got it.
Moxon lifted his .45 and pointed it at Perry's chest. An evil grin tightened the big youth's round face. Dean walked to one side through the pools of gasoline, leaving Lewis to circle around the other. When he had the angle he wanted, Dean fired the Browning rapidly, zipping rounds past the empty space not covered by the heavy bulletproof plexiglass. The sec man grinned, pointing down at the boys. That stopped when one of his sec men caught a flattened and slowed bullet that cored through the side of his head and tore his jaw off. The others were in shock, watching as the dying man collapsed against the plexiglass with blood spraying from his ruined face. The man tore the plexiglass sheet from the grips of the men who were struggling to hold it stable. Released, the plexiglass came crashing down into the lower room, splashing gasoline all over the place. Dean continued firing, driving the sec men back, taking down two more of them. The other boys joined them in blasting the sec team. The double doors abruptly jerked open, just as Vinge Conrad appeared behind the single remaining plexiglass sheet. He had his gun in hand and was scowling down into the room, his eyes locked with Dean's.
You arrogant little whelp! I might have known you'd be ringleading this.
Dean exchanged his empty clip for a fresh one. The double doors gaped completely open. Gasoline drained over the edge. Raising his Browning, Dean put three rounds into the plexiglass sheet in front of Conrad's face. The Baron grinned, not worried at all that the bullets might penetrate.
You do me proud, boy. Truly you do. Now you haul ass out of there and kill everything you can. Don't let your guard down even for a moment, because they're all going to be out to kill you.
He took out a match, scratched at the life on his jeans, and applied it to a torch he got from one of his sec men.
Get moving! Fly or fry!
The torch caught easily. The Baron let it burn for a moment, giving the flames time to grow stronger.
Dean! Time to go!
Without another word, Conrad pitched the torch out into the open. Sparks peeled back off it as it dropped, smoke coiling in the trail it made through the empty air. Dean turned and ran for the double doors. Lewis was waiting, his face pale with fear, eyes reflecting the falling torch. The boys started leaping out into the pit. As Dean reached the double doors, he tried not to think about slipping and falling into the gasoline. A wave of blue flames, turning yellow on the ends from the richness of the fuel, trailed him to the double doors. Lewis and Dean leapt from the edge out into the night. Before they made it to the ground, the flames rushed through the double doors after them. Coiling, the fire followed the stream of gasoline from the doors down the 15 feet to the ground. The flames also set Dean's gasoline-saturated boots on fire. He felt the heat flare up around his calves, scorching his pant legs. When the fire hit the ground, it instantly spread across the gasoline pooled at the base of the room at Bally's, lighting up the area at once. Dean landed hard. Ahead of him, and a few yards to his right, he spotted a bowl of water nearly 3 yards across. He ran to the water until he was almost knee-deep in the pool. White smoke curled up from the surface. A bullet whizzed by Dean's head. By then, the second bullet was already on its way. Enrique Green spun and went down on his butt, grabbing at his left leg. Dean hunkered down in the water, his weapon ready. Moxon and Lewis grabbed Green's arms. Together, they dragged the boy to cover behind a stand of trees. Bobby Handley already had a strip of cloth torn from his own shirt, ready to make a compress to cover the wound.
Anybody see the son of a bitch did this?
I got him.
Jordy Ferguson lay behind a wag lying on its side, a sniper rifle extended before him, snugged into his shoulder.
He's in that tree out there. How far?
Still low in the water, his backside almost touching the surface, Dean glanced at the tree Jordy was talking about. A muzzle flashed in the branches, and a third round dug a hole in the muddy ground near Green's position.
120, 140 yards?
Which one?
Split the difference. Knock that guy's lights out before he kills one of us.
Ferguson worked the range marking on his telescopic sight, lifted the rifle, and squeezed off a shot, quickly working the bolt action and readying another round. The second bullet wasn't necessary. In the distance, the sniper dropped from the tree. Dean started to move from the water, but something rubbery and strong wrapped around his leg and wouldn't let him move. A gray body rose up, pulled along by the limb that gripped Dean. It was a mutie of some kind. That was all Dean knew for sure. At first glance, he could see that the thing had five rubbery limbs nearly 6 feet in length. Then Dean realized that one of the limbs had eyes, three of them, spaced in a triangular shape. In the center was an algae-covered shell that looked whole, then opened up into a teeth-filled mouth big enough to bite Dean's head off his neck. Two more limbs rubbed around the boy's left arm and his neck, pulling the creature's mouth toward his abdomen. Jaws extended, filled with razor-sharp ivory, reaching for Dean's flesh. Dean drew chunks of the shell away from the creature, sending the jaws retreating. As the limbs withdrew from their tight embrace, Dean put three more rounds through the appendage with the eyes. The muty beast dropped Dean on the dirt and slid back into the dark water.
Holy shit, that was close.
Dean backed away with his Browning pointing at the pool. He was shaking, but tried to get over it quick as he joined the other boys. Lewis was staring intently at the terrain.
Solomon used to say that every battlefield was like a chessboard. Always said the best place to take was the high ground. That over there, I figure, is about the highest ground we could take.
Following the direction the blonde youth was pointing, Dean made out the red neon lights proclaiming the mirage. He squinted his eyes, not daring to believe what he was seeing, then realized that his eyes hadn't played tricks on him. Five, possibly six stories up on the building, water gushed out, creating falls that fell somewhere in front of it, lost in trees and foliage. Connor frowned.
Place is huge. Be hard to hold.
We're not going to try to hold the whole thing. We'll just find a place inside it that we can hold. Wait things out and make them come to us.
Supposed to be chilling these people out here.
That's what you want to do, Enrique? Start wandering around finding people and things to chill? This isn't a shooting gallery. Me? I'm just wanting to get out of here with as much of my own skin intact as I can.
They said they'd chill us if we didn't fight. I believe them, Lewis.
I don't figure they're planning on letting any of us out of here. And that's the truth. We never even heard about these five barons and their seven vills until a few days ago. Hell, we didn't even know anything about Solomon either. If they let us go, they'd know they were in for some trouble from maybe our parents, maybe us on down the line. Safe Jack's just to kill us and be done with it.
You got a mean way of putting things.
It's a mean world.
Best way is like Lewis said. Chill anybody we have to, but keep an eye out for a chance to get out of this place.
No one said anything, but most of them shuffled nervously, flinching when they heard a sudden spurt of gunfire to the east of them. For a moment, Dean almost thought it was his dad's Steyr. Then he shoved the idea away. It was just a hope that he had no business nursing along. His dad was a long way from this place. Hayden Lamarck stood behind Baron Hardco's chair and stared out the bulletproof window. His hand rested on his Glock, the restraining strap popped loose. Wallace Thurgood stood at his side. The other barons sat in chairs in front of the window as well, two Sekhmen allowed in with each of them. The window gave a view of the pit that had been created of the quake-stricken area. Baron Detweiler glanced condescendingly at Vinge Conrad. Detweiler was a huge, fat man with a bald head, and many people made the mistake of thinking Detweiler was soft or simple. Neither was the truth. The fat disguised hard bands of muscle, and Detweiler had a preference for biting out the throat of anyone he fought in hand-to-hand combat.
You sent boys into that pit, Vinge. Were you addled when you made that decision?
Conrad hoisted a glass filled with beer and took a long drink. He wiped the foam from his beard with the back of his hand.
You haven't seen those boys in action. Trying to get them out into the pit, they chilled four of my men in that room. Injured seven others before we chased them out with burning gasoline.
They shot bullets through the plaz sheets.
Now, not through the plaz. Little bastards bounced bullets off the wall.
Francis Giscard's youthful face broke into a delighted smile. He raised his glass.
I've never seen or heard of that being done. I must compliment you on your choice of champions this year. They appear to be most industrious. Conrad, where did you get them?
One of the wall Sekhmen near the old Las Vegas Convention Center raised a flash with a purple lens cover, signaling twice. The barons had thermographic binoculars and could see a person's body heat through the walls of buildings. Special rad buttons inside the body armor, treated so they reflected different levels of light, announced the color of the person they looked at. Deke Ramsey, the remaining baron, shook his head. He was tall and ruddy. His rust-red hair shot through with gray and thinning on the top.
It appears that you've lost a couple more men, Giscard. That brings your total loss to what, five?
Four. And might I remind you, I need only one to win.
He leaned forward and slid two more purple beads across the freestanding abacus on the low table in front of him.
Conrad, I await your answer.
Well, you can wait on it. It's my secret.
Detweiler rubbed his chin as he cast a thoughtful look at the pit.
You haven't lost a fighter yet, Conrad. Usually the mortality rate runs much higher at this point of the game. Perhaps we didn't include enough beasts and muties this year.
Nah, there's plenty. People we got out there, they're better chillers than most.
Seems to be true.
Something I want to ask you, Giscard.
Ask away, Conrad.
Assuming that you, by some freak of accident, managed to win, what do you plan on doing with the Seven Vills?
I plan on living a life of luxury for a year. I'm painfully overdue, as you're well aware.
Wasn't talking about that. I was talking about the construction that Hardco's managed to do this year.
Lamarck felt a tremor of anxiety. The statement confirmed that Conrad did have spies among their people at the Seven Vills. And he, Lamarck, hadn't found all of them. He ground his teeth.
An intelligent man would take what I've started and keep on building.
That's what you think?
Yeah.
You're saying I'm not an intelligent man?
Lamarck shifted in response to the new stances assumed by the Sekhmen behind Conrad. His hand closed hard around the butt of the Glock.
Didn't say that.
I think you did.
Hardco shrugged. His pistol was in his lap, barely covered by a red cloth napkin, with white dice showing black pips on the faces.
Up to you what to think.
Conrad's wolfish grin was devoid of anything near human emotion, showing only cold calculation.
Better hope you win, Hardco, because I'm going to burn you out if you don't, and that's a promise.
Out on the wall, a Sekhmen raised a flash with a red lens. It blinked on and off. Lamarck surprised himself by holding his breath, waiting for the lens to flash again. But it was only the once. Hardco leaned forward and slid over another red bead on the abacus on the table in front of him.
Your second casualty.
Only my first in this Mars arena. It's sure a fit place for that old god of war. But the big game is young yet. Don't count your victims before you see them stretch cold on the slabs in the morning.
Lamarck hated the man's confidence, but his thoughts turned instantly to the red team out in the pit, wondering which among them had been lost. He hoped it wasn't the one-eyed man. Ryan went to ground, rolling over twice to put more yardage between himself and a big, muty cat. The huge animal's shoulder stood almost as tall as Ryan's armpit. Its fur was gold with a black ridge from head to thrashing tail. White fangs stabbed free of purple-gray lips, drooling crystal-clear strings. Whiskers bristling, the animal sprang. Both bullets creased the raised muscle mass surrounding the cat's neck. Neither did any permanent damage.
Get back, Ryan, and give me some room!
Before she could get a beat on it, the cat smashed into Ryan. He barely managed to avoid the snapping jaws, but the impact knocked the Sig Sauer from his hand. There was no time to bring up the Steyr, because the muty cat wheeled around instantly. Whipping its head forward again, the cat tried to sink its fangs into Ryan's throat. Ryan caught the cat by its dish-shaped ears, halting the wedge-shaped head. Instantly changing tactics, the cat curled up backward and tried to bring its claw-studded hind legs into play. Already expecting the move, Ryan wasn't there when the claws slashed. Before the animal could come around, Ryan grabbed a fistful of the loose hide at its neck. With a live jump, he bounded onto the cat's shoulders, gripping the fur-covered flesh he had hold of as tightly as he could, then locked his legs around in front of the cat's forward legs so it couldn't rip him to shreds with its hind claws. The cat spun and twisted wildly, trying to rid itself of its burden. Ryan held on, putting his body on top of the cat's, weighing down the animal's head. He leaned forward, actually biting into the animal's neck in an attempt to forge one more point of attachment. Left-handed, he ripped the panga free and reached under the muty cat's neck, stabbing it repeatedly in the chest. The cat snapped its jaws as he pulled the knife free again, barely missing sinking its ivory fangs into Ryan's arm. Ryan had difficulty breathing, choking on the wet, smelly fur in his mouth, the smell of fresh blood clogging his nostrils. Knowing he couldn't hang on to the cat much longer, he drew the panga hard against the muty cat's throat, pulling with everything he had left. The effort unseated him from the cat's back, but not before he felt the cascade of hot blood spill in waves across his knife arm. Ryan sailed backward. The cat had already turned, searching for its tormentor, scarlet staining its purple-gray lips and black fur of its throat. Landing hard on his side, Ryan forced himself to roll over and get to his feet as the big cat padded toward him. He spotted the Sig Sauer on the ground, but it was to the muty cat's left. Getting it was impossible without coming too close to the injured animal.
Ryan!
It was the only warning Ryan got about the scabby that exploded out of the brush with a spear held at waist level. Reacting to the attacker, Ryan shifted his body, letting the triangular spearhead slide past him, ripping along the scarlet armored vest. Ryan grabbed the forward haft of the spear, watching a look of surprise spread across the scabby's rad-burned features. Continuing to use his weight and strength to push down on the spear, Ryan buried it point first into the ground. He used the added leverage to pole vault the scabby toward the muty cat. The scabby flew upside down, smashing against the beast's snarling face. The cat closed its jaws over the muty's head and shoulders. Still hanging onto the spear, Ryan ran to the muty cat's side and rammed the spear in behind the cat's foreleg, aiming for the heart. The cat lifted a paw and swatted at Ryan.
Shit!
The claws came close enough to shear his hair and break the skin along his forehead. Warm blood slipped across Ryan's face. The paw slapped against the embedded spear, snapping the haft as if it were a straw. It took a step at Ryan, who moved off to recover his Sig Sauer. The animal's hindquarters shivered, then dropped out from under it. The eyes were already glazing before its head slammed against the ground. Ryan raked a hand through his hair and moved it back out of his face. He kept his Sig Sauer ready. Turning back toward his people, he saw other dead scabbies on the ground. Waiting for his heart rate to slow to somewhere near normal, Ryan used the time to reload the partially spent magazine in his gun, then do the same to the clips he'd used inside the holding area.
Everybody okay?
Not everybody.
JB nodded to where one of the Thompson brothers lay on the ground, a short-hafted axe jutting from his cracked skull. The other twin knelt by him, holding his sibling's bloody hand. Ryan crossed to the younger man. He put a hand on Thompson's shoulder and shook it.
Got no time for grief. We need to be pushing on.
Fuck you, mister. My brother needs burying.
You plan on staying to bury him?
It's the Christian thing to do. I don't feel good about just leaving him here like this.
I know it's hard to leave, but it's got to be done if you're gonna have a chance to tell your kids about their uncle. Only way he's gonna live on.
tenderly, laying his dead brother's hands across his chest, Taylor stood. His jaw tightened, becoming a hard line as he gripped the haft of the axe and pulled it from the dead man's skull.
Then let's get moving. You see that tall building there, Mildred?
The Mirage? You want to go there?
Highest vantage point. We get inside there. Maybe we don't have to worry about the animals or the muties so much.
We aren't going to be the only ones thinking like that.
Kind of planned on that. Some of the other groups will think of it eventually. Be best, maybe, if we were already set up and waiting for them. I don't think any of the five barons have made any converts tonight. Could be, we can offer to let them throw in their lot with us. The Mirage is close to the wall on that side.
Maybe. Even if we made a way across the wall, chilled our way through the Sekhmen keeping watch there, we'd still have to find a wag and get enough of a head start on the barons that they couldn't catch us.
Mentally, Ryan plotted a course toward the Mirage that would take advantage of as much cover along the way as possible.
I know. The traitor always said, no matter how many beers you drink,
you can only take one piss at a time.